Deepika, and thank you to the Sangha and community here for inviting me to speak on Dhamma, and especially with the presence of very senior and august Sangha here, Venerable Nyanaramita, Venerable Nisarana, the Sangha members. So we have the chance to speak on Dhamma this evening, and as always, when we have the chance to speak on Dhamma, we should begin by preparing our mind. And so we want to give a talk on the topic of mindfulness, meditation and Nibbana. But of course, there's so many Dhamma talks in the world, aren't there, these days? We can all go to listen to Dhamma talks on YouTube and all those places. In fact, you could probably listen to Dhamma talks 24 hours a day from now until the day you died, and you would never exhaust all the Dhamma talks in the world. Yeah? But would you be more mindful? Would you be more peaceful? Would you be more awakened? I don't know. I hope so. I hope so. But that depends on you, doesn't it? So when the Buddha talked about the how right view came to be, he said there were two factors which are important. Paradogahoso and yonisa manisikara. And paradogahoso is the voice of another. Right? So the voice of another is what we're doing here. You're listening to my voice. Or when you're reading the suttas or you're discussing Dhamma and so on, there's some external source of wisdom and Dhamma. So this is one of the things that gives rise to wisdom, gives rise to right view. But the other thing that gives rise to right view is yoniso manasikara. Right? And so that's when you take that Dhamma that you've heard and you apply it inside yourself. And this is the part that is so often missing. And so often when we listen to Dhamma, we sit there and we just sort of let it wash over us and so on. And many times when I finish Dhamma talks and afterwards people say, oh, that was a wonderful Dhamma talk. And then I say, what was it about? In the Buddha's day, people would listen to a Dhamma talk and they would remember it. You'd memorize the talk while you're listening to it. What's the difference? Why is that? It's because of yoniso manasikara. Because of paying close attention and taking those words and applying it to yourself. So since we're giving a talk on mindfulness, meditation and Nibbana, we're going to do a bit of meditation, hopefully being a bit mindful, and who knows, maybe even realizing Nibbana, okay? Who knows? I mean, the thing with Nibbana is that it's just right there. We think of Nibbana as being this kind of unattainable thing on some remote hilltop that the great sages in the past realized and all those things. And the Buddha said Nibbana is just the ending of greed, hate and delusion. You know what greed is like, right? You've all had greed. You know what hate is like. You've all had hate. You know what delusion is like. You've all had delusion. When those things end, that's what Nibbana is. So it's not something that's so very far away. It's not something that's so very hard to conceive of. But it is something that's hard to realize. And so this is why we do the meditation. So in just a minute, we're going to do some guided meditation. And I'll lead you in some guided mindfulness meditation. But first, I want to say a few words on how we do meditation practice. Okay? Number one rule in meditation is there are many kinds of meditation methods. Right? So don't worry too much about it. You'll learn different meditation from different monks or different nuns or different teachers, different books, different suttas. It's okay. Don't worry. Try different meditations, practice them, see, do they lead to peace? Does it lead to wisdom? Does it lead to mindfulness? That's good enough. Okay, so don't get caught up in thinking there has to be one right way to meditate or anything like that. Different ways of meditating are just different ways of helping you to become more peaceful and more wise. That's all. So that's rule number one with meditation. Rule number two with meditation is don't meditate in Pali. Don't meditate in Pali. What do I mean by that? Right? What I mean by that is people come up and they say, oh, I was meditating and I had this jhana, or I had this piti, or I had this sampatti, or something like that. And they're thinking about their meditation in terms of some kind of doctrinal category that they've read from some sutta or from some book, or that they've heard from some Dhamma talk. And as soon as I hear that, I immediately just dismiss what they say. I don't believe them. If someone comes and tells me, oh, I have such a jhana, or someone has such a jhana, I don't believe you. All right? There's no point in telling me that and thinking I'm going to be impressed. Okay? It's just a word. Right? If you're talking to me about your meditation, I want to hear what your experience is like. Right? Describe to me what you felt your experience is like. Then we can begin to understand what's happening in your meditation. Right? So very often when we're meditating, we immediately want to interpret everything in terms of some doctrine. Right? But this is all back to front. The point of the doctrines is to point you to meditation, not the other way around. Right? That's why we teach. We use the words about meditation to point towards the experience. So this is what if you ever listen to my Dhamma talks and these kinds of things, meditation talks especially, you'll notice that I never really use Pali words. I never use technical words when talking about meditation, only very rarely. And this is the reason why, because people get attached to those words. They think it means something special. So don't meditate in Pali, right? Meditate in the language of the heart. Meditate through your experience. Know what it's like for you. Okay? So these are two rules for meditation. Now, I mentioned before that when we're thinking about these things and thinking about the Dhamma, that there are these two aspects, the voice of another, the yonaso manasikara. So I'm going to apply both of those aspects as I talk about these topics. Now, when we talk, and I'm going to do two things. I'm going to try to, on the one hand, I'm going to try to give some practical advice and help in these things. At the same time, I want to give perhaps some more technical reflections on these things from my perspective as a Pali translator. Now, meditation. Let's take each in turn. Meditation. What's meditation? Well, meditation, of course, is an English word which traditionally meant really thinking contemplatively about something, a sort of reflective thought process is a meditation. And it was one of those words which was adopted in the 19th century by the early generations of Pali scholars and gradually became applied in the context of Buddhism. And of course, those first scholars who were talking about it in an English context really didn't have any idea what meditation was. They were really just guessing, stumbling, and it's remarkable that they managed to get so many things right. So we've come to think of meditation, now the meaning of it has changed. It doesn't mean reflective thinking anymore. Meditation these days means a practice of awareness. Now typically when we think of meditation, we think of a formal spiritual practice. Well, it might not even be spiritual actually for many people these days. Meditation isn't really part of a spiritual path, it's just for relieving stress or relieving tension. But in any case, it's a formal practice. That means that you set aside a period of time. You set aside a period of time and you say, I'm going to meditate from this time to this time. You sit in a particular posture. You maybe do a small ritual before or afterwards and so on. And so there are various elements that set aside this period so that you can do your dedicated spiritual practice. All right? Now, this is important. It's essential, actually. Right? And there are some people who say, oh, you don't need to meditate, just be mindful in everything you do. And I say to them, good luck with that. Have you ever tried being mindful in everything you do? It's not a competition, right? It's not like saying, oh, we have to, one thing is better than the other, right? But it's crucial, it's critical that you set aside formal periods of time to meditate. Right? If you don't, your progress will never go deep. It's as simple as that. Right? Why do we need to do this? Well, see what you're doing when you have a formal time to meditate is that essentially you're setting aside a safe space. Like all of the formalities of a meditation period, right, they're like a circle or a perimeter that you can draw around that meditation, and you can say, within that period, it's okay. It's my safe space. And you know, when we talk about meditation, right? When you read the brochures or someone's advertising a meditation course or something, they say, you know, find peace of mind, you find happiness and all of those wonderful things. Just advertising. Don't take it too seriously. Actually, what happens in meditation is much more complicated than that. Actually, if you're meditating in that period of time between that point when you start meditating and the point when you finish meditating, pretty much anything can happen, and it probably will. And if you meditate for long enough, then in that period of meditation, you will cry, you will laugh, you will scream, you will fall asleep, you will be seized by terror. You will become incredibly angry. You will sit there for a whole hour plotting revenge against your enemy. You will sit there for another hour thinking about breakfast. All of those things will happen in your meditation. Alright? And it's okay. Right? That period of meditation, it's okay. All of those things will happen because that's human experience. Gradually, little bit by little bit, you'll find that those things tend to happen a bit less, and you find, oh yes, there is that peace. There is that happiness. Yeah? Gradually you'll move towards that. Oh, you feel that grow within you. And some people like to meditate and get results quickly. Those people are idiots. Meditation is not something that you're going to get results with quickly, unless, okay, very, very few people maybe can do that. But don't think of meditation like that. Think of meditation as being like your best friend that you're going to grow up and spend the rest of your life with. Yeah? You're going to grow old with it. Yeah? Every day, doing your practice. And you'll go through so many different phases, so many different things that you'll experience. And sometimes you'll feel despair. Oh, this is going nowhere. I'm completely lost. Sometimes you'll be full of doubt. And you'll be like, oh, what is this? What am I doing? I'm wasting my time. This is stupid. I'm just sitting here, literally just sitting here doing nothing. Yeah. And sometimes you'll reach that point when you experience a kind of peace and a kind of clarity that you never knew existed. And your mind will touch that moment of clarity. And in that moment, you will see everything so very clearly. And so within that period of meditation, we have to allow anything to happen. And that's why you need that formal period of meditation. Not just, I'm going to be mindful whatever I do. You can't say, I'm going to be mindful when I do the shopping, and then halfway when you're down the aisle of the shopping centre, then break out in tears because some memory from your childhood came up. You can't do it. You have to cope, right? You can't say, oh, I'm going to be mindful while I'm crossing the road, and then all of a sudden in the middle of the road, oh, my mind's so peaceful, I'm just going to stand here and not move. Right? Maybe you should. If you died while your mind was like that, it might be a very good rebirth. I don't know. But anyway, so we have to cope. So in that meditation, it's a period when you don't have to cope. You don't have to be anyone. You don't have to do anything. All you have to do is be with your own mind. And so it's critical that we spend at least some time every day having that formal period of meditation. Now, in Pali, when we talk about meditation, we don't have like a single word that's exactly the same as what we mean in English when we talk about meditation. There's actually many words in Pali that talk about meditation in different ways. And I'm sure you're familiar with many of them. Bhavana, or more specifically, Chitta Bhavana is a common word for meditation in Pali. But then there are many others. The word padhana sometimes means meditation. Jhana, of course, is a particular state of meditation. Then you have like anupassana is like a contemplative meditation and so on. But one word for meditation which I'd like to point out, two words for meditation I'd like to point out that we sometimes don't think are words for meditation as such. One of them is the Pali word viharati or vihara. And this is, viharati is an extremely common word in Pali, meaning to dwell or stay or abide. And it's used just in an ordinary sense. You know, you have a vihara is a monastery, a dwelling place. Or you might have Bhagava Savati on viharati, the Buddha was staying in Savati. So in that way it has just an ordinary everyday meaning. But it also is commonly used as a term for meditation. For example, you have the Nava Anupubha Vihara, the nine successive viharas. Okay, so nine successive meditation states, right, which are the four jhanas, four arupas, and cessation. So in that context, vihara means a state of meditation. And this is actually quite commonly used in the suttas. And there are many passages where actually, once you recognize that, then there's many passages in the suttas where you can see things with a slightly more clear perspective. For example, you commonly find a passage that might say something like, and the bhikkhu dwells contemplating impermanence, just as an example off the top of my head. And so bhikkhu dwells contemplating impermanence. But when you say they dwell contemplating impermanence, it's not really exactly very clear. What does that mean? I'm dwelling contemplating impermanence, right? But actually the word viharati in that context means to meditate contemplating impermanence. Right? This is what it's talking about. So sometimes depending on how it's translated, we might miss the fact that it's actually talking about meditation. Another word that's used that means meditation but is often not recognized as such is the word satipatthana. And the word satipatthana is often translated quite literally as establishment of mindfulness or foundation of mindfulness. And of course, that's what it means. But if we look at the normal way that this is used in the suttas, the normal way is ida bhikkhave bhikkhu. Aranya katova, rukar mulam katova, sunyagara katova, nisidati palankanga bujitva, ujunkayan panidaya, parimakam sating upat petwa. So the bhikkhu gone to the forest, the root of a tree, an empty place, sits down cross-legged, sets his body erect, and establishes mindfulness, parimukam sating upat petwa. And the phrase sating upat petwa is in Pali just a verbal resolution of the word satipatthana. And so it simply means does satipatthana. But clearly what's being referred to in that passage is that they meditate. And then it goes on, so satova asasati, satova asasati. Mindfully breathes in, mindfully breathes out. So in that context, in the normal context that the word Satipatthana is used in the suttas, it specifically means meditation, beginning to meditate. And it's referring to what we normally talk about when we talk about meditation. Right? You go to find a place to meditate, you sit down, you get in your meditation posture, and then you watch your breath coming in and out. It's exactly what we call meditation. So that word Satipatthana actually really just means meditation. Now these days people talk a lot about what they call mindfulness in daily life. Right? Now, first of all, I hate that phrase. I really do. What other kind of life is there than daily life? There's just life, okay? I don't like that phrase. Just mindfulness in life or living or something. I don't know what. Anyway, mindfulness in life. And you may be familiar with the stock passage in the suttas. It talks about a bhikkhu going out and coming back, putting on their robe, eating their food, going to the toilet and so on. But the interesting thing is that in that passage, it doesn't actually use the word mindfulness. It doesn't use the word sati. It uses the word sampajana. And sampajana kari hoti. He acts with awareness, sampajana. So there's a couple of things going on here. First of all, is that this passage, talking about awareness of one's activities, is taught specifically in the context of the monastic lifestyle. Right? We don't find this teaching being given to lay people. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that lay people can't or shouldn't practice awareness of their body and their postures and so on. But also, we shouldn't ignore the context, right? It's different. What's being described here as part of the monastic lifestyle is as part of a contemplative and meditative routine that the monk or the nun would have been meditating in the evening, getting up early, maybe doing some chanting, some meditation, and then preparing themselves to go into the village for alms. And that going into the village for alms is often, in a monk's lifestyle, it's often the most exciting thing we do all day, right? Depending on what we're doing. And you get to see things, people and elephants and these days cars and billboards and all those kinds of things. And so it's about preparing yourself to do that, but it's still a very simple activity, right? Wearing your robes, walking. You're not doing complicated things, you're doing very simple things. And so those simple, ordinary processes, which is happening and conducts that's happening in monastic lifestyle, then we practice being aware of those things. And it's, of course, it's quite different from maintaining awareness when your phone's ringing and your kids are screaming and there's someone knocking at the door and all of those kinds of things are happening. Yeah? Again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be trying to be mindful and so on. I'm just saying be aware that the context is different. Okay? Don't be too down on yourself if you're struggling to be mindful in that context. Yeah? It's okay. But that word sampajanya, rather than meaning mindfulness as such, means awareness, or more specifically, it means situational awareness. And situational awareness is a bit of a buzzword in modern psychology, which originally came from military circles, and specifically from the Air Force. And they noticed that certain fighter pilots would survive in air battles and dogfights and others would not. And they investigated as to why that was. And the thing that they came up with that differentiated an ace pilot from the ones who got shot down was this thing that they called situational awareness. It means awareness of everything that's happening at that time. Awareness of where the other person is, what you're doing, what your machine is doing, what the capability is, what you're trying to achieve, where you're going. And so there's this ability to have that awareness and understanding. And in, of course, a very different context, but this is very similar to what the Buddha was talking about with Sampajanya. So it's not just awareness of the position of your body, but it's awareness of the purpose of your movement. It's awareness of your context. And I learned the difference between mindfulness and awareness, situational awareness, just after my first retreat. My first retreat in Thailand, Wat Rampang, I did a month-long intensive Vipassana retreat, practicing very much moment-to-moment mindfulness. Right? Everything very slow, pick up glass like this, picking up, bringing. You have to note everything, bringing. Drinking, putting down. Right? So this is something that you can only do in that very specialized environment, in a meditation retreat. It's like a training. Now we finished the retreat, and after the retreat, they asked us to help out in the monastery. They said, they came to the meditators and said, oh look, we have a bit of work to do, can you give us a hand? We said, of course. And they had demolished a kuti, just a wooden kuti, and they wanted to move the timber from one end of the monastery to another. So they got a few of us meditators to come and help out. And of course we're just wearing thin rubber flip-flops. And when we're about to step into the building site, right? So this is like the first thing that in my life that I'd ever done after the meditation retreat. And so I'm like really full of myself. I'm so mindful. I've done all this meditation. Now I'm going to be really good at this. And I'm just going to keep being mindful during this whole process, right? I'm going to be aware of everything I pick up, everything I put on the trailer, everything we do. I'm going to be mindful. I took one step into that building site and went straight onto a nail. Straight through my flip-flops into my feet. That was it. I had to go back. I was an invalid for the rest of the day. So this is, I was perfectly mindful. My foot is raising up, my foot is moving across, my foot is going down, my foot's going onto a nail. Pain. Mindful, but no awareness, no sampajanya, right? No awareness of the context, right? I didn't have any understanding. So my mindfulness was focused too narrowly. I trained it in one way, but it needed to be applied in another way. Right? So when we're practicing meditation, we're practicing mindfulness, then we need to know what is the context. Right? So I talked a little bit about meditation. I've talked a little bit about mindfulness. One more detail I'd just like to mention about mindfulness before moving on is just to remind us all, as I think we always need to be reminded, that the Buddha never taught mindfulness. Oh my God, shock horror. What am I saying? No. The Buddha taught sati. We translated it into mindfulness. Or specifically, Thomas Rhys Davids translated it into mindfulness and we followed his example. So the Buddha taught sati. And the word sati basically means memory, recollection. And sati is defined in the suttas as the ability to recall and recollect what was said and done long ago. All right? So does that mean that when you're meditating, that you sit down to meditate and you think about things that were happening long ago? Is that right? Sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? If that's true, then everything we've ever heard about meditation is wrong. So we're in big trouble. But it's undeniable. That's what it says in the suttas. Am I right, Venerables? Yes, that's what it says in the suttas. So, what's going on here? Okay, well, of course, when we're thinking about and reflecting on these Dhamma words and Dhamma ideas, never forget that these are subtle and complex ideas. Don't just take them up on the surface. They have a depth to them. They have a profundity to them. And we need to reflect, and sometimes we learn over a long period of time. It takes to really learn what is going on with these things. So the point with this idea of mindfulness being memory is really to do with continuity. Right? Continuity. Think about what happens when you watch your breath. We did a little bit of anapanasati, a little bit of breath meditation earlier. Watching breathing coming in and out, mindful of breathing coming in and out. Oh, what was that? And then we forget, right? Your mind's going off doing this and that. That's what mindfulness of breathing is, remembering to watch your breath, remembering to be aware, right? Keeping the breath in mind, right? So that aspect of keeping is what the sati is about in meditation. Keeping continuity. In Satipatthana, it talks about kaya kayana passi viharati. And the operative word there is anupassi. Anupassi. Passi means observing or watching. Anu means continually. Keep on watching. Keep on watching. Keep on watching. And the word viharati has that sense as well, to dwell, to stay, to remain, right? To keep on watching. So this is what that meditation is, and this is what that mindfulness meditation is. And so when we do this, through the practice of mindfulness meditation, the Buddha said that the outcome, the purpose of mindfulness meditation is samadhi. This is why mindfulness is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Samadhi, in other words, the four jhanas, is the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Mindfulness, right mindfulness, leads to right samadhi. Right? And that's what it means. It means when you're watching your breath, being aware continuously over a long period of time, letting the breath calm you down and bringing your mind to a state of stillness, and the mind will converge, will immerse, it will sink into a state of samadhi, where it will become unified. And that is the outcome of right mindfulness. The other word that I was supposed to talk about this evening is the word nibbana, or idea. We're talking about nibbana. I mentioned earlier that it's good to not think of nibbana as something very mystical and very distant, but think of it as something that's very empirical. It's very relatable. Okay? We get angry. It feels bad. Right? I mean, it kind of feels good. At least you're alive, right? You get angry and you're yelling at someone or something like that. But actually, you know inside yourself it's really bad. So when the anger disappears, you can let go of that peace. Yeah? And that's a little taste of the peace of nibbana. Right? Same thing with greed. You have that so much greed or desire for something, your mind can't stop thinking about it. So when you can let go of that, your mind is at peace. And the same thing with delusion. Like maybe you might be doubting about something, you don't understand something, and then you have some insight, a moment of understanding arises, and it feels good, it feels nice to know things. So we can see in our own experience that flavour, that we understand what kind of thing nibbana is. We can get a little foretaste of what nibbana is. And when we go deeper into meditation, we can taste that flavour more clearly. Every time that our mind becomes peaceful and drops down further into meditation, further into meditation, further into stillness. And we can feel all of the worries of the world being let go. All of that ridiculous rubbish that we were worried about. Oh my God, so much rubbish. And gradually it goes, little bit by little bit by little bit. All those burdens, all those completely unnecessary things that we've been carrying around. Little bit by little bit we throw them away, let them go. And your mind becomes more and more peaceful. That's how we understand what nibbana is. Nibbana isn't something separate, which we somehow, it's somehow over there, and we walk on the path and we get there, and the path has nothing to do with nibbana, right? That's how we think sometimes. I'm going to be here, I'm going to do all of these things, and I have no real understanding of why these things are going to get me to that distant place that we call nirvana. Right? But each step that we take, each moment that we practice, each bit of letting go that we realize inside ourselves, that is teaching us what nirvana is like. When, as a translator, when working with this, many translators don't translate nirvana. They just leave it as nirvana or the Sanskritic nirvana. I don't like that. I think that creates an unnecessarily mystical feel to the word. Many years ago, I was reading a little bit about psychology, and I learned a fact I didn't know, which is that Sigmund Freud, the founder of modern psychology, psychiatry, he's very famous for his teachings about the ego, the id, the superego, and I found out that he actually never used those words in his writings. Never once did he use the word ego in his writing. Never once did he use the word id in his writing. No. He used the ordinary German words, das, what is it? Das ich, I think, the I, das ich, yeah, ich, yeah. And the ego, he just says that the I and the it. Yeah. And when they translated his works into English, they thought that didn't sound formal enough, didn't sound technical enough, so they put it in Latin, right? And so then it becomes like a thing. You think ego is like this thing. I always remember when I was trying to understand what he was talking about, what is this thing called the ego? But actually he's just talking about the I, the sense of I. So it's the same thing, we do the same thing in Buddhism. If you translate nirvana, if you refuse to translate nirvana and you make it some special word, you give it a capital letter. Right? There's no capital letters in Pali. Right? Nirvana. It's a big thing. Actually, it just means extinguishment. When the flame goes out, it's nirvana. Quenching or extinguishment. Yeah, this is what nirvana means. They're perfectly good English words. Yeah. That's it. This, what we have, this suffering, this desire, all of these things, goes out. And then people are afraid. They say, oh, you can't say that because people will be afraid of nirvana. Good! You should be afraid of nirvana, right? When the devas hear about the Buddha's teachings, they're horrified. They think, what? You mean this world we thought was permanent and everlasting, it's really impermanent? They're terrified, yeah? Good. They should be. Yeah? So the teaching of nirvana, the teaching of extinguishment, quenching, it's a challenging teaching. It's a powerful teaching. It's one that can be shocking. It should be. A spiritual path should be shocking. It should have something that shakes you, that makes you consider what's going on. What is my life? What are my values? How am I living? And if until we start to feel that way and start to question things down to their core, then we're not really setting out on that spiritual path. So we should ask ourselves, we're practicing Dhamma. Are we practicing for Nibbana? Are we really practicing to let go sabbapatinissaggi, to let go of everything? Your children, your parents, your family, your job, your career, your house? Are you really practicing to let go of all those things? Huh? The other day somebody asked me how should they begin practicing letting go? How should you begin practicing letting go? I said, easy. To begin practicing letting go, say goodbye to your family, give up all your possessions, resign your job, give away all your money, walk out of your door and live in the forest. That's the beginning of letting go. And I'm sure the Venerables will agree with me that there's a lot of letting go to do once you've done that, right? That's just like a first step. Yeah? So, if we're going to be talking about this nirvana, nirvana isn't something to be worshipped, it's not something to be turned into a god or a deity or anything like that. Nirvana is a reality to be experienced. And every time that we let go of greed, hate and delusion, even just a little bit, we're learning a bit deeper in our own minds what nibbana, what extinguishment, what the ending of suffering is really all about. So that's my talk for you this evening on mindfulness, meditation and nibbana, and I thank you very much for your attention.